On the face of it, the Edelsteins appear to be a stereotypical middle-class nuclear family. Dad is a lawyer. Mom is involved with various projects outside the home. Son Joseph is a sullen teen with a consuming interest in metaphysics. Sister Rose is about to turn 9. Her birthday cake changes everything, and family secrets begin to bubble to the surface. These characters have been created by Amy Bender in a new novel called The Particular Sadness of Lemon Cake. She's in our studio at NPR West. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Rose's mom bakes a lemon cake with chocolate frosting. It's the night before Rose's 9th birthday. What happens when Rose bites into it?
Well, she has this sensation in the cake, which she's not sure what to do with, because it tastes like a very good tasting cake, but there are these kind of there's like an emptiness or a hollowness in the cake that really unsettles her and that she kind of associates with her mom, but she's not sure why.
So she's tasting someone's feelings, really.
Exactly. She finds out basically that she is tasting feelings in the cake, but often feelings that people aren't aware that they're feeling, so they're kind of baked into the cake unknowingly, and then she kind of takes them in.
Or secrets that they're keeping.
Right. Secrets that they're keeping.
She is also unable to eat some toast her brother Joseph makes. What does she taste when she gets something from her brother?
I mean, it almost, to her, the toast tastes like it's closing in on itself, like almost like a sea anemone or something that is that feeling of an inward motion, something inedible. She has to spit it out. She can't even swallow the toast.
Right. Joseph is a loner all of his life. All he wants to do is be alone, and he's completely focused on this quote-unquote work he is doing, which involves graphs and the cosmos and all of that. I read a review of the book, and it suggested that maybe this character had either agoraphobia or Asperger's syndrome. Did you consider that when you were writing the character?
You know, it's interesting because I can see both of those things fitting the character, and a couple other people have had other ideas about him that kind of fit as well. And I think there's just something I guess I'm trying to describe about him. And then I'm perfectly happy for people to come in and then kind of diagnose him. But yeah. I didn't want to diagnose him. And I kind of felt like that was important.
Yes. And you can't project too much of that, trying to put him in a category, because it's really not until the end of the book that you figure out what's going on with him. And I can't give it away.
Yeah. Thank you.
let me get back to Rose, though.
Okay. Okay.
Does she get feelings with everything she eats?
Well, the distinction that she discovers, because any food that's made by a person is loaded, and it's either loaded with these secrets or these feelings that the person is not aware of, or, sometimes good feelings, too. But the only food she can eat without worry about encountering something unknown in that person is processed food, because processed food is made in factories and is usually made by machines that don't have feelings. So a bag of Doritos for her is a kind of enormous relief from this onslaught that she gets with every other meal.
So she essentially survives by eating processed food.
Yeah, exactly.
But she begins to be able to know what factory it was made in, what kind of factory it was made in. I mean, she really starts to be able to know so much about where a particular, food came from as she grows older in the book.
It's almost like the power of someone's feelings is so overpowering that the distraction of trying to learn about the details of other elements of the food gives her also another out. So it's almost like she's able to learn about factories and learn about the transportation of food, and that kind of can get her mind off of, this person is, deeply sad, or here's a person who's full of anger, or whatever feeling she's encountering.
Yeah, and it's horrible when she's 9 and she doesn't know what's happening to her, and they take her to the emergency room and she wants them to take her mouth off.
Yeah.
But that can't happen. Right. But she survives.
She does. I mean, ultimately, she does. It's... I guess my hope is that there's a survival, but with the complexity that it's something she's trying to figure out, but she's pointed in a good direction.
Right. I'm speaking with Amy Bender, author of the new novel, The Particular Sadness of Lemon Cake. You also wrote earlier, I mean, you've been a successful author, Willful Creatures is a book of yours, An Invisible Sign of My Own, The Girl in the Flammable Skirt are yours. How did this, writing this, compare to your earlier work?
You know, every book is a little different, and I'd heard this was my second novel, though I'd had some kind of failed attempts at novels before I wrote this one. And people had said, well, once you write your first novel, you know, the second novel, you kind of know the ropes. And I thought, okay, I'm going to know the ropes. And then I completely didn't know the ropes because, you know, the second time around, it turns out they're not ropes. You know, it's like a whole different mechanism. And so I think there was something about writing this book that did feel a little different, though each book feels different. But maybe I think fairy tales have been a huge influence in past books. And although this story has magical elements, they feel a little bit less fairy tale based in some way, or there was something about language that felt a little different, like the scenes were longer than maybe scenes are in short stories or even in my first book, maybe. I mean, there's some long scenes in that too. But
you don't use quotation marks when you're writing dialogue.
Yeah, I often don't, and I don't in this book. Kind of aesthetic choice in a certain way because I like how it looks, but it also feels like that line between her internal and external world is a little blurry, which I think is kind of her deal.
Yeah. Did you base Rose on anyone you knew or a combination of people you knew?
You know, probably a combination of many people, certainly elements of myself, but also elements of friends and family. I can sort of see pieces of dialogue or gestures that came from friends or family or me. So I think every character ends up being some kind of mix like
sure.
that.
Sure, yeah. But, you know, after all, you're writing about a girl who's nine. You've been nine. You know what it's like to be the last one picked at, you know, dodgeball.
True.
And, you know, and then that first love that comes when, you know, Rose thinks she's in love with Joseph's best friend. And then you follow her on, you know, up into her young adulthood. So,
yeah.
But it can't be all about you.
No, it's not. It's always, I think because she's an invented character, then it's like so there's just that soup of whatever, wherever the writing comes from, and then the character kind of congeals out of that soup. And so she's a little bit of a lot of people.
Of course, the metaphor has to be soup, right?
I mean, right, of course. Can't help it.
Can't help it. Not in the food book.
Not intentionally either.
Amy Bender's new novel, The Particular Sadness of Lemon Cake, has just been published, and she spoke to us from NPR West. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. Throughout history, generations in every world culture and society have passed on wisdom through stories. The ancient fables and tales offer life lessons, and they all contain archetypal characters. Consider the trickster, a creature or being that loves to create chaos. In Native American traditions, it takes many forms and appears in many stories. The first graphic anthology of some of those tales has just been published. Trickster combines folklore and comics. Matt Dembicki, who founded a comic creators collaborative here in Washington, edited the collection. He's also one of the illustrators, and he's here in our D.C. studio. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
In Native American lore, how many and what are the forms that the trickster takes?
I think there's many forms, and depending on the geographic area of the tribe, it will kind of dictate which animal or being it is. I think people are very familiar with coyote and the rabbit, perhaps not so familiar with the raccoon and the raven.
What was your vision for this collection?
Initially, the way it started is I was reading a prose book about tricksters and Native American trickster stories, and I just became fascinated with it. And coming from a cartoonist point of view, I started doodling and seeing what I could do, and I wanted to kind of incorporate perhaps some of the Native American look to the illustrations. And as I was doing it, it kind of dawned on me that this would be perhaps a really interesting collection.
How did you pair the storytellers with the illustrators?
The storyteller would send me their story, or they would recite it over the phone or something, and I would transcribe it. And I had like a pool of cartoonists, and I would kind of determine which three or four would do a good job illustrating it. I made sure that they had a selection of styles from a cartoony style to a more realistic style. And then I would send samples to the storytellers who decided who they wanted to work with.
Oh.
And so it kind of gave them, I think, a little bit more buy-in into the process so they're more comfortable with it and to kind of, I guess, represent the vision that they had for the story.
The styles really, it's a wide range. I mean, you've got those moody, dark figures, you know, that you'd see in like The Dark Knight or something like mm-hmm. that. And then, I mean, there's one story, Rabbit's Choctaw Tale. Mm-hmm. That's hard to say three times fast. This one reminds me of the old Ren and Stimpy cartoons. tell us all a little bit about this one.
Well, that one was illustrated by Pat Lewis, and he's very influenced by the Warner Brothers type of style from the 50s cartoons like Tex Avery. And like you said, it's just completely wild and it's fun and it's different. And that's just kind of, in terms of different styles artistically, it worked out that way. I think it kind of represents what the storytellers themselves are like as individuals, what their preferences are. Some people prefer more realistic. Some people like the kind of fun, cartoony aspect of it.
Yeah. There's another one that I want you to talk about, and this is one that our listeners can actually hear. Joseph Stands with Many. He reads the story in an audio slideshow at our website, npr.org. But tell us the backstory of how Wildcat caught a turkey.
What I like particularly about this story is the kind of the simplicity of it. You know, it's not text heavy. And that's kind of one of the great things about cartooning is Joseph provided the story and John interpreted it in cartoons.
John the illustrator?
John Sperry, yeah. Mm-hmm. He's the person who did the artwork for it. And as you see here, almost the first three pages are textless.
Yeah.
In terms of how you move the story along. And it's not until the fourth page that you get some of the text in there. And a lot of it kind of focuses on food. The wildcat catches the rabbit, and the rabbit says, look, if you let me go, I promise you I'll be able to provide you with a meal. Some turkeys over there. And so the wildcat decides to kind of go with what the rabbit is telling him. And so he plays dead and kind of tricks the turkeys into coming over and looking at the wildcat. Huh. And, of course, the wildcat is not dead. He was just playing possum, essentially. So that's kind of I noticed that was kind of a theme in some of the stories in terms of playing possum.
Yeah. I'm speaking with Matt Dembicki, who is the editor of a new anthology of Native American tales called Trickster. Are there more tales to be told? I mean, do you think you might branch out to other cultures or other archetypal characters?
At this point, I don't think so. The reason is this project was really intense to find the storytellers and make them feel comfortable with the process. I think all the storytellers, except for maybe one person, were familiar with comics, but they weren't familiar with how we'd be able to translate these stories into a comic form. There's a little bit of doubt about how we're going to do it, some cultural sensitivity. And so I think just winning the storyteller's confidence in that the book would be presented in an appropriate light took a while.
How did you finally get their confidence? I'm imagining you picking up the phone and calling one of these storytellers and say, how would you like to work on a graphic collection? I mean, what would you say on that particular phone call if they said, well, why would I want to do that?
You know, that was tough. it wasn't easy convincing everybody. Some people really couldn't see it being done this way. Other people had some cultural issues.
Yeah.
You know, they were very adamant about, you know, these are mostly oral stories. You know, they're told orally, and they should be told orally. I had some interesting stories about some people who went back to their tribal elders and told them about the project, expecting them to say, well, we don't want to do this. We don't know where it's going to go. They came back, and they said, you know, they're into it. They want to do it. And I think the reason they wanted to do it was, with all the competing media for people's attention, I think they felt they were losing a hold of their storytelling tradition, and they wanted to preserve some of these stories in a different format. It wasn't the ideal format for them, but they wanted to make sure that it was there, you know, to preserve it for their own children and for everyone else as well.
Matt Dembicki is an illustrator and the editor of Trickster, Native American Tales, a graphic collection. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
For more than a decade, the rate of teen pregnancies in America steadily went down. But A study released a few months ago shows that that decline ended in 2006 when the rate started to go back up. It raised questions about the value of abstinence-only sex education programs. So under a new program, the Obama administration has devoted $100 million to fund sex education programs with proven records of reducing teen pregnancy, even if they don't only focus on abstinence. NPR's Brenda Wilson has this report on one program considered to be among the most successful in the country.
Michael Carrera spent years developing a teen pregnancy prevention program, an interest that grew out of his experiences as a teacher in the Bronx 50 years ago.
I learned that if you spoke about sexuality to young people, they sat still.
Carrera is now a well-known expert on adolescent development and sexuality education. He's worked for a long time in poor communities and learned. Young people have troubles that can't always be quantified: family, peers, and self-esteem issues.
They brought them all with them, including their thirst for knowledge about sexuality and their interest in being with other boys and girls to talk about it. I concluded that the way to get the sexuality message to stick was to link it to all the other things that made them whole young people.
First sponsored by New York City's Children's AIDS Society in 1984, Carrera's program now has a number of in-school and after-school operations in the U.S. It's one of 28 programs approved by the Obama administration because they've shown they can get children to delay sex. Carrera's model is being phased into the curriculum of the Arts and Technology Academy, a public charter school in one of Washington, D.C.'s poorest neighborhoods.
All right, is everyone ready to play?
In Arthi Shastri's fifth grade family life and sexuality education class, they're playing a game that challenges their ideas about gender.
All right, ladies, which gender tends to talk more in conversations?
Females.
Not correct, sorry. The answer is males. When people are having conversations, studies show that males are the ones that talk more.
Later in the afternoon, Shastri's older seventh graders take on the more grown-up subject of what happens to teens during puberty.
The point of puberty is what?
Hair.
Hair is something that happens during puberty, right? But what can their bodies do as adults that they can't do as kids?
Sex.
Right. So what is the consequence that can come from that? Tomate.
What?
Thank you.
Carrera says giving young people information about sex is not the same thing as giving them permission to have sex.
That's what this is about. Sexual ignorance is not bliss. You do not make responsible decisions in the dark.
He says young people need to know what options are available in life besides having children. That's why Carrera's program has a job club. Students learn about the world of work, get a stipend, and keep a bank account. There's self-expression through music, art, and athletics they can pursue a lifetime. All activities that are known to delay sex. Susan Philiber, an independent evaluator, has seen the difference between teenagers in Carrera's New York City program and other teenagers in the city.
So we followed them right up into some very high-risk years. In the program group, 10% got pregnant, but in the control group, it was 22%. That's more than double the percentage, and impressive.
There's also comprehensive medical, dental, and mental health care. Philiber says a girl in the program is not only more likely to use contraceptives, but protection against sexually transmitted infections.
Because she's saying, you know, I want this protection. I don't want any risk here. I'm in school. I need to think about other things.
But Philiber says it doesn't work for everyone.
The boys that became the most difficult to engage in the program were the ones who, by the age of 13, had already been sexually active. So these were high-risk little boys.
So the program now starts early and goes from grade 5 to the end of high school. It's hard to find people who don't like the Carrera model, including Ron Hoskins of the Brookings Institution. He was a senior advisor to President George W. Bush at a time when abstinence-only programs were hotly debated. Hoskins admires Carrera, but wonders if others could faithfully adapt his program.
imagine the organization and the funding that you have to do all the things that CRERA does. I mean, by the time you have help with schoolwork and you have organized athletics and you have visits to various places in the community, that you have a college prep, and even more than that.
CRERA's program cost about $2,500 per student. Most of that comes from national and local foundations. There are other programs on the administration's list for middle-class kids, white kids, Latino kids, and black kids, though few are as comprehensive as CRERA's. Brenda Wilson, NPR News.
The madness begins in South Africa Friday when the 2010 Soccer World Cup opens. Over the course of a month, teams from 32 countries will vie for the title of world's greatest. Here to handicap the competition and tell us all we need to know to enjoy watching it are Alan Black and David Henry Sterry, authors of The Glorious World Cup, A Fanatic's Guide. Alan joins us from member station KQED in San Francisco. Hi, Alan.
Hello.
And David is in our bureau in New York. Welcome to you, David.
Thank you so much for having us on.
The best place to start for us, I think, is to talk about this country's chances. The U.S. faces England next Saturday in our opening match. How good are the Americans?
Well, traditionally, America has basically had two shots at winning the World Cup, and those were slim and none. But we finally have some great athletes who've been playing soccer their whole lives. Last year in South Africa, they had the Confederations Cup. And America, they didn't just beat Spain, they walloped them. And they almost beat Brazil in the final. So if you're an American soccer fanatic like we are, you believe in your deep secret heart that we actually have a chance if the soccer gods smile upon us.
Alan Black, how good are the Brits?
Well, the Brits, it will depend on whether or not they bring their spine to the game. Part of the English disease sometimes can be spinelessness, so it will depend on whether it's been inserted into their backbone, so we'll see.
Oh, yeah. Now, the last time, I mean, it says here that the last time the U.S. faced off against England was 1950. Is that right?
60 years ago to the
day. In the World Cup, yeah. And it was a stunner, I'm told.
It was. England was considered the greatest team in the world at that point, and America was basically a bunch of really, really good amateurs. And they won, 1-0. It was the greatest American sports upset that you never heard of.
Alan, as someone who is not that familiar with football and what we call soccer, can you tell us how the competition works? Because it's not single elimination initially, right?
No, there are 32 teams. And in the first round of the tournament, they are divided into groups of four. And the top two teams in each group will then go on to the second round of the tournament, which is called the round of 16. And after the round of 16, it's an elimination contest. So you win, you go on, you lose, you go home.
Mm. Alan, what would you say are some of the other early matches to watch?
Some of the games that Germany are playing, I think, are going to be interesting. They're playing against Ghana, and there's a bit of a grudge there that emerged recently when the German captain had his ankle broken by one of the Ghana players. So if you're looking for some kind of revenge factor, then I would certainly tune in to that game. There are plenty of other great games coming up. And North Korea, that's the team I'm supporting, by the way, in the World Cup. They bring a total opposite approach to everybody else in the World Cup. There's a current fetish in soccer to have attacking football and everything to be the desire to score a goal, but North Korea plays total defense. And so by being completely opposite, they're hoping that they can have some kind of a contrarian view that will bring them to glory.
Well, you know, in this country, we have a certain madness in the month of March, the NCAA college basketball tournaments. And there's always, you know, this basketball team, they call them the Cinderella team. It sneaks its way into the finals. David, is there a possible glass slipper wearer, or actually several in this World Cup?
Yes, absolutely. Ivory Coast is, I think, going to make some real noise in the tournament. They have a striker named Didier Drogba. He's fantastically skilled, fast, big. I'm also rooting for Cameroon, in part because I love to say that name, Cameroon.
Oh, I thought you'd like to say the word goal. I mean,
but I do love. Oh, come on, that's not like, that's love. Come on.
That's right.
Alan Black, on Sunday, July 11th, who will be left standing?
I think should things go well for Argentina, they are likely to be there. They're a complex team. They have fabulous players, but they have the incendiary Diego Maradona as their coach. So it will depend on whether Diego brings his relaxed persona or his crazed post-cocaine madness. As a dark horse, I would say I'm looking at Serbia, which has got an interesting, strong technical team.
David, what are your picks for July 11th?
I would love to see, as I say, Ivory Coast. And usually Brazil, of course, they've got all those great one-name stars, Kaká, Rubinho, Luis Sao. They're so fun to just say. Portugal has a shot. They have some wonderful players. Spain is heavily favored. I don't think Spain is going to make it because of the fragile psyche of their country.
All right, you heard it here first, folks. Alan Black and David Sterry are the authors of The Glorious World Cup, A Fanatic's Guide. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, and go USA.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
And as David mentioned, more Americans bought tickets to see the matches at the World Cup than any other visiting nationality. The popularity of the game is growing at such a fast rate in the U.S. that it will soon be one of soccer's biggest markets. It's one of the many statistics in a 2010 World Cup and Economics report published by Goldman Sachs. Andrew Swift is a researcher for Foreign Policy magazine and a writer for its Passport blog. He's been digging through that report, and he joins me to talk about it. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, why does Goldman Sachs put out a World Cup analysis and index?
Maybe it's to get some good press.
Yeah, they probably need it.
They've had some troubles lately, so maybe putting out a football report on the World Cup is a way for people to get another look at them.
Okay, fine. So they analyze the economies and the political situations in each country, and I gather there is a correlation between a country's productivity and their ranking according to FIFA, the football International Football Association. Can you explain that?
Yeah. Goldman uses something called GES, which is Growth Environment Scores, which is a roundup of factors from political, economic, and social. It's like rule of law, corruption, debt, and then social factors like computers and mobile phones. They found, interestingly enough, that a GES score and FIFA ranking itself is not necessarily correlated.
Right.
But the improvement over the last 4 years in GES score and FIFA ranking is, and this trend is especially noticeable among developing countries.
So, like, as Brazil becomes more economically powerful, its FIFA ranking goes up anyway?
Brazil and Argentina are sort of the outliers.
Right, because they're good anyway.
Yeah, exactly. They've been good for so long, right. And their GES scores are not necessarily a proper indicator of their skill level.
So what's a good example?
Algeria, for example, is the one they listed. Algeria did not qualify for the 2006 finals in Germany. Did this year. They're in the group with England, the United States, and Slovenia. And Algeria was the country that posted the highest improvement in both the GES score and FIFA ranking over the last 4 years.
Their economy's getting better. Their political situation's getting better.
Yeah. Goldman attributed this, to maybe better infrastructure or funding facilities, for football leagues.
What I found quite astonishing about this report is the importance of the United States to the world soccer market. Mm-hmm. Can you explain why that is?
Well, I'm part of a generation that grew up millions and millions of kids playing soccer, boys and
leagues.
Girls. Yeah, exactly. Granted, 8-year-olds playing soccer is not particularly organized. It's really a bunch of kids just running around chasing the ball.
Yeah.
But I think that familiarity is starting to breed genuine interest in the game globally. 24.5 million Americans play some sort of soccer, and that's the second highest number in the world behind China.
Wow.
Major League Soccer, the U.S. domestic league, is in its 15th year of an existence now. And just earlier this year in April, they announced that they have higher average attendance figures. It's about 18,500 per MLS game than both the NBA and the NHL, about 1,000 more.
Both the NBA?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
More people on average view soccer games in America now than NBA games or hockey games.
Yep. It was shocking to myself, actually.
Andrew Swift, this report, the Goldman Sachs report, actually gives its odds for who will be in the semifinals, mm-hmm. who will win. What does it say?
It's England, Brazil, Argentina, and Spain. I'd say three of those, England, Brazil, and Spain, are sort of conventional wisdom. Personally, I'm rooting for the U.S. I think we have a shot at beating England in the group stages. I think we could upset, you know, surprise some people. And then I think we also might have a chance if we finish second in our group, we'll likely face Germany in the round of 16. I think we can surprise some people there as well.
That's Andrew Swift. He's a researcher for foreign policy, and he's covering the World Cup for the magazine's blog. It's called Passport. Andrew Swift, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. If you've heard Carla Hall's cooking segments on this program, you'll know that the former Top Chef finalist would have been delighted to make a meal out of oysters. But when we met up with Carla a few days ago, we had another seafood delicacy in mind for her to cook, something easily available at her local Safeway, where our story begins. Carla, where are we standing?
We are standing in the canned meat aisle. There's some sardines here.
And we actually asked you to make something with sardines.
Yes.
Do you know why we asked you to do that?
I actually don't know why you asked me to do it.
Well, here's the thing. Every time I go to the supermarket now, it seems like the kind of fish that is sustainable and so on changes every week.
Right.
You know, one week you can have tuna, one week you can have cod, one week you can't.
Uh-huh.
It's confusing.
Right.
So we're not eating a lot of fish.
Right, because people are confused about it.
But sardines are plentiful.
Yes.
They're cheap.
Yes.
They're available everywhere.
Right.
And they're really healthy.
Well, yeah, they are available everywhere in a can.
In a can.
Yes.
But they can still be pretty delicious out of a can.
Okay, well, that's why I chose to do this, because I want you to prove it to me, and I need to prove it to myself. Oftentimes, I'm making things for other people. They will say they don't like something, and I will say, well, no, why don't you try it like this? So this is me, you know, doing what I say to other people.
Gotcha. All right. So we've turned the tables on you.
Yes, you have.
Now, Carla not only dislikes sardines, she doesn't eat them. And so she decided that to make them palatable, she had to make a ratatouille to pair with the sardines.
Ratatouille is a vegetable dish. I mean, it's tomatoes, eggplant, zucchini, garlic. You can throw anything else in that. I'm going to throw in some fennel and pump it up with lemon, because I think it'll be really good with the sardines. And also we're going to throw some chilies in there.
All right, so what am I doing first?
All right, so what you're going to do is just to cut these tomatoes in half crosswise.
Okay, so let me go ahead and
start
chopping.
So you're going to do all of that. I'm going to start dicing my zucchini.
A ratatouille is about fresh, seasonal tastes, but also about beautiful, colorful vegetables and herbs. And Carla likes it crunchy, so she carefully slices the green outer part of the zucchini, about a half-inch thickness. What's left is a white rectangular zucchini core. She doesn't use that part because it makes ratatouille mushy. Instead, she suggests you chop it up for zucchini soup. Now, a ratatouille isn't just about the payoff at the end. It's also about the process, the chopping and dicing. In this case, a quarter-inch dice. So when you make it, turn on the radio, crack open a beer, or pour a glass of wine, because it'll take some time.
This is I got to tell you, Carla, this is a beautiful dice. Really beautiful.
I'm going to have you do some. I'm going
to... I'm intimidated because this is such a beautiful dice.
But you know what? I'm going to stand right here with you, and I'm going to show you how to...
Don't judge me, please.
I'm not going to judge you.
Don't judge me.
But I'm going to judge myself if you don't do it right, because I didn't teach you it well. Oh, look at that. Beautiful. Gorgeous. Yours is more gorgeous than mine. Your knife must be better.
I've been taught by a master chef 5 minutes ago.
Once everything's chopped, it's time to start cooking.
So, one of the things that I do when I cook zucchini and yellow squash, I toss the zucchini and yellow squash in oil. I don't put the oil in my pan. Because when it turns, all the sides of the cubes are coated in oil.
Oh.
And these are all the little things that, honestly, I may not say in a recipe because it gets a little long-winded. And if you see the recipe, I'm like, well, dang, look at all those steps. And, you know. So you just have to listen to NPR to get that tip.
Now, this recipe is really about sardines, and in this case, canned Brisling sardines, not filleted sardines. Again, because they're cheap, plentiful, sustainable, and good for you. The challenge for Carla was to make them taste good.
You all set?
I'm all set.
Okay, we are now ready to open up the cans of sardines.
We're ready to do it.
We're ready. Are you ready?
Yeah, we have two cans. Wow. Oh, it's good.
Very mild, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a really mild fish.
Oh my God.
It's not like...
Why haven't I had it?
Really, really simple, mild fish.
Okay, this is me saying that I'm going to open up another can.
Awesome.
I know. Okay.
All right.
After a little experimentation, we decide to sprinkle some fresh chopped rosemary and chili onto the sardines and then dredge them in flour for a quick pan fry.
Mmm! The rosemary and the... Oh, my God.
They're great.
The rosemary and the chilies are so subtle, but they come... Oh, my God. I've been missing out. Oh, my God. All right, so we'll finish these, and then we'll just plate up, yeah?
Yep. All right, we have finished everything now.
Yeah.
Everything's been chopped. Mm-hmm. You've plated these. They look beautiful. Each plate has three or four sardines sort of piled on this ratatouille.
Yep.
I have a fork.
You have a fork. I have a fork, and we're going in.
We're going in.
Mmm. It's as if we've stepped...
onto a veranda.
Yes.
On a Greek island.
Yes.
Having lunch.
Yep. And to all of you out there who don't like sardines, you have to try this before you say you don't like it.
And if you want to try Carla Hall's recipe for pan-fried sardines with ratatouille, you can find it at our website, npr.org. You can also learn more about Carla at her website, alchemycaterers.com.